Welcome, listeners of Lusion to Temporal Discussion, the episode-by-episode nightmare retrospective podcast. I'm Martin Harder, and I haven't had a good blip-blop in years.
And I'm Jake Collins. And when I cross the road, I don't usually get to the other side because I'm a lollipop person.
Are you actually a lollipop person? Is that do you do that, actually?
I do. It's one of the many pies in which I have a finger.
Today we're looking at Series 4, Episode 14. The episode was originally broadcast on CITV on Friday, December the 7th, 1990. Vanilla Ice remained frozen at number one with Ice Ice Baby, and those heroes in a half shell, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, were still topping the box office. I don't have much to say about Vanilla Ice. There is a lot I could say about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You're not really a fan, are you?
Not a huge fan, no. I was caught up a lot in the fad of Teenage Mutant Ninja Hero Turtles at the time, but it's not something I've kept close to my heart ever since. As I said in the previous episode, if you want to hear me and Rosie saying pretty much all we have to say about it, you can listen to our podcast on the subject, which is mainly about the cartoon series and the action figure line.
So you bring up the Hero Turtles thing. We do have a few American listeners. So those who don't know, the original cartoon over here, the name was changed to Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles because there was a weird thing going on with British censorship at the time, wasn't there? And one of the things was that you couldn't have the word ninja in anything because it was deemed too violent, and you couldn't have anything depicting the use of nunchucks, which really kind of screwed over Michelangelo a little bit.
It was a futile thing to do. Ninja was written on a lot of the merchandise. I had the turtle blimp, for example, with Ninja Turtles written on it. It does make some odd cuts in the UK broadcast version of the episodes with Michelangelo's nunchucks.
A lot of it doesn't make sense in the UK version.
I think Panthro got away with it a lot more on Thundercats on Going Live. Censorship is extremely subjective, and it's never going to make perfect sense to anyone, I think.
Temporal Discussion. Temporal Discussion. Bringing you the latest news from 1990.
In the news, President Bush applauded the decision by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to free hostages in Iraq, but he stuck to his tough stance and refused to provide Saddam any incentives to remove his forces from Kuwait, such as tying the Persian Gulf crisis to a settlement of the Palestinian issue. Declaring that Saddam's action to free the hostages is evidence that the US policy of economic sanctions combined with the threat of war is working, Bush pressed Saddam to fully abide by UN resolutions demanding the withdrawal of Iraqi troops from Kuwait and the restoration of the country's government. During a tour of five countries in Latin America, Bush said at a press conference, "We've got to keep the pressure on, but the problem is the aggression against Kuwait, and the man must leave Kuwait without reservation, without condition." Bush's rhetoric, as well as similar statements made by Secretary of State James A. Baker III in Washington before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, demonstrated the administration's resolve to keep the international coalition united against Saddam and from being undermined by growing discussions about the potential diplomatic agreement. They also threatened to use force if Iraqi troops were not removed by early 1991. US officials seemed especially keen to make sure that the release of hostages did not increase the support on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in the country for postponing military action against Iraq for several months in order to extend the effectiveness of economic sanctions against the country. So it's not quite war yet, is it? Or at least it's not the ground war yet.
Yeah, so it does seem kind of inevitable now.
And now time turns. The recording light burns. Timeout is gone. The podcast is on.
Greetings. Here we are, still celebrating the victory of Dickon and his friends over the dungeon. Yes, the catacombs have been defeated. And what may be beaten once can be beaten again. Eh, Pickle? So, what of our newest challenge? How goes it?
No problems, Master. No problems. Three A's and a J from London come to challenge give to our dungeon. That's Alexander, Amanda, and Anthony. J for Jeremy is their dungeoneer. The shield is their quest, and they're just 8 or 9 minutes down the path which leads to towards level 2, if I'm not mistaken. No magic, Master, but bags of pluck.
And they'll need it. Oh dear. Pickle, these are so young. They're almost new. Still, time presses. Let's get on with it.
Well, they have the eye shield, Master.
Yes, a very useful artifact, the eye shield team. With it, Jeremy may be able to see after a fashion, a distinctly magical fashion, and therefore somewhat unreliable. Now, Jeremy, hold the eye shield up across your chest. It may take some time to make best use of its powers. For it to work best, it must get used to its wearer. Now, onward, team.
Okay, go forward.
Yes, little time to lose, so out you go with the dust. Sweep, sweep, sweep.
Take a side, some side steps.
All in enough to work, say aye.
Look, Master, the eye shield's working.
Yes, it seems. Onward.
Okay, Jeremy. We can see you walking along this garden path. And there seems to be a hole or something a few steps.
Strange ways, no. Strange paths. What do you make of this, Pickle?
Well, Master, it is written, so I believe, Amanda. To the forest of Dun the foolhardy come. And though they soon learn, they seldom return. Walk on.
Yes.
What
is that? I don't know.
Is that just a bush?
Not a place to linger.
What's that? Keep going, Jeremy. Okay, Jeremy, you've got to be quick on this one. There's a house in front of you and there's a phantom coming towards you, sir.
Look and fail. Listen, team, if my memory serves me true, this inn is called the Crazed Heifer. It's a notorious gathering place for thieves and fellow travellers.
The sprite is right, team. Inns like this are dubious places, but information and supplies can be had here. Now, no adventure is without risk, and the risk is up to you.
Jeremy has arrived at the picturesque entrance of the Crazed Heifer. There's what we're calling a proto-pooka here. It's our name for the hand-drawn series 4 and 5 versions of the pooka. It doesn't seem to be doing anything other than looking slightly menacing. The team don't quite line Jeremy up with the door correctly, and as such, he almost walks into the stationary spectre before multiple course corrections send him through the door. One of the things about this team that does irritate me a little bit is they're not very good at manoeuvring.
That's very true. And I do think, as a general rule, these very young teams do tend to be worse at manoeuvring, not panicking, really getting to grips with trying to play the game effectively. And I think Jeremy's team is a good example of that.
The main problem with this team is that they immediately follow Dickens, and that's not their fault. It's like, how do you follow that?
That is so true. So before Jeremy goes into the Crazed Heifer, let's give a shout out to Annie Canadown on the Nightmare Forum, who listened to all these podcasts, but specifically Series 4, Episode 11, where I talked about the exterior of the Crazed Heifer. Annie was inspired to say on the Nightmare Forum, after listening to the Series 4, Episode 11 podcast, Jake is correct. Annie has linked to her pictures of the real-life exterior of the Crazed Heifer, and she tells us it is the 14th century Little Hall in Lavenham, Suffolk, which was originally a house and is now a museum. As we know, the interior is not Little Hall, Lavenham, it's Dragon Hall in Norwich, but the exterior, yes, there it is, Little Hall, Lavenham, Suffolk.
Annie has her own website with photos from Leeds Castle and other places which show side by side the locations in Nightmare.
So that side step to your right. Forward.
Another customer. Come in, young sir. Sit yourself down. That's it. There you go. Help yourself to something. All right. So anyways, come on. Concentrate, you lot.
Yes, sir.
3 years go by, right? And the monk has a visit. Yeah, you guessed it. It's the crone. Scrap me, says the monk. Yeah. You've grown young and lovely. That potion must have worked a treat. Give over, says the crone. It worked the potion.
eating it with a funny looking powder you gave me for the cat.
Should I put it in my lap?
Oh dear. This is the last time we does the rural circuit. Thick. I've seen turnips brighter than this lot. This is no place for a profession.
As Motley finishes his evidently awful joke, Jeremy knapsacks some bread that is on the table. Motley approaches him, and after introducing himself, he laments that his brand of comedy isn't going down too well with the Heifer's clientele. What he needs, he claims, is some new material, something fresh that he can no doubt sap all the humour out of. He proposes a deal. If Jeremy can tell him a joke that he hasn't heard before, Motley will aid him in his quest. Advisor Anthony suggests Jeremy tell him the "why did the chicken cross the road" joke, and Jeremy does so.
Yeah, quite how Motley hasn't heard this joke yet, which was it had to already have been old in the time period which the scene is set in. I've got no idea.
Interestingly enough, it does actually create a specific continuity error with Series 3. Motley heard the joke from Dungeoneer Martin in the kitchen. Why did the punk cross the road?
Yeah.
Because he was stapled to the chicken. And Motley genuinely enjoyed that joke, unlike Leo's crazy rabbit joke.
Despite the fact that it would make no sense if he hadn't heard this joke before.
Exactly.
Okay, look, I've got a little something here you might like. It's a bit of magic, right? But it won't work for me, more's the pity. Now, it's called joke. You can only tell it once.
Motley notices that some of the inn's customers, particularly the one played by Michael Kuehl in the background of the shot, are taking a rather disquieted interest in Jeremy's presence. He guides Jeremy to the exit and to another passive bar.
Disquieted. Can you tell I got the thesaurus out for that?
I did suspect after some of the things that have been said on the podcast before, but I thought it was a very fine word to use there.
I've got a really bad thesaurus. It's terrible, but also it's terrible.
When I appeared on episode 1 of this series, I spoke about those moments in series 4 that were different, that made me sit up and pay attention. And the joke spell very much is one of them. I was pleased to see Motley give it out. It's appropriate to him. He's a jester. He's given out the joke spell. I was interested to see how that was going to be used, and I wasn't disappointed later in the episode. That's one of the highlights of this episode for me, I think. Something different, something fun, something Motley appropriate that Motley brings to the quest.
There you go, right. Oh, coming up to some stairs here. Turn around. There you go. This one. It's a lovely day today.
Okay, you're going down some stairs.
There you go.
Keep going. Okay, keep on walking, Jeremy.
Ah, it seems we're back in the woods, team. But it's still a dangerous place, and not a place to linger.
Yeah.
I hear footsteps, Master. What? And I don't think they're Jeremy's.
Uh-oh. Walk back faster.
Hurry on.
Quick.
Okay, Jeremy, stop. Right. You're in the middle of a wood, and there's a big tree to the right of you, and
a tree stump
in the background.
It looks like it's got something.
No, it's a door. It's a door. Yes, it's a door. Okay, and there's a tree stump just in front of you.
Objects of interest here, I think. King.
Upon the tree trunk today are a side of ham, an hourglass, a bar of gold, and a gauntlet. The ham gets knapsacked, and Oakley appears.
Uh-oh.
A
caution, Jeremy. This is Oakley, a tree troll, we think, though no one seems quite sure. In any case, it's a guardian of the greenwood and highly suspicious.
I hate thieves. All humans is thieves and despoilers. Prove yourself if you be tree friend, or I crush you.
In the middle of England grew the Shire Wood. What name do you know it by?
The correct answer is Sherwood Forest, which they give, and it's quite an obvious answer, in my opinion. But Sherwood Forest is the remnants of an ancient royal woodland in Nottinghamshire, England, with a long history associated with the Robin Hood tale. pollen sampling cores show that the area has been wooded since the end of the last glacial period. And today's Sherwood Forest National Nature Reserve covers 424.75 hectares, which is around 1,049.6 acres, including the settlement of Edwinstow and Thoresbury Hall. Its name derives from its status as Nottinghamshire's Shire, or Sherwood, which stretched into many surrounding counties or shires and was bordered to the west by the River Erwash and the Forest of East Derbyshire. Sherwood Forest is home to the major oak, an 800 to 1,000-year-old oak tree whose limbs have been partially supported by scaffolding since the Victorian era. In February 1998, a local company took cuttings from the historic oak and started to cultivate clones with the goal of distributing saplings to major cities throughout the world. And I didn't find out whether that was successful or not.
I must just mention briefly, as a point of interest, Sherwood Forest stretched as far up as South Yorkshire, and that is the only place in England where a settlement called Loxley is known to exist. Yorkshire has its Robin Hood connections, Robin Hood's Bay being one of them. So perhaps that's where Robin Hood entered Sherwood Forest from the top of it, South Yorkshire. But of course, we'll never know for certain.
So we have a go at Kevin Costner for not doing a proper, like what we would consider a Robin Hood accent, but maybe he should have been doing a Yorkshire accent.
It's very possible.
Which, of course, is bull because he should have actually been speaking French.
Yeah. I was pleased at the time that Oakley had realised, finally, with his Greenwood-themed questions, he should be asking Robin Hood-themed questions. He asked one to Giles as well in the next episode. But when we see him again one time in Series 5, he's forgotten all about Robin Hood and he asks something else. More in the region of Super Ted, I would say.
The best version of Robin Hood was probably the one that was showing on the other channel around this time. Marianne.
What is the tallest kind of tree there?
Okay, so they answer elm. They don't know the answer. It's better to give an answer that you're not sure about than it is to not say anything.
Exactly. Because it's quite obscure, really, expecting this very young team or thinking this very young team might know anything about Californian redwoods.
Yeah, and it makes me think that maybe this wasn't actually the answer they were looking for. I think maybe they were looking for like oak or something like that. But the tallest species of tree in the world is the coastal redwood. And the tallest known example of this species is the Hyperion. Located in Redwood National Park in California, the Hyperion is over 379 feet tall. And for our American listeners, that's roughly the same height as 231 Madagascan penguins.
That's interesting you say that about what answer they were looking for, because it links to something I have in my mind to say about the riddle book from the Nightmare board game, which is extremely interesting to a Nightmare fan. And this is where I first found out, when I got the board game just after Nightmare ended, what the answer was to this riddle, what they were hoping for. And I think it's fair to assume that the answers given in the riddle book are the answers from the show. It's the riddles from the show and the answers from the show to go with them. And it does actually say Redwood.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
Okay.
Reading that riddle book is an extremely interesting experience for that. Also, you can see some different versions of riddles, different phrasings of certain riddles. Some of them have different alternative answers. That who was the first hobbit to hold the ring question has three different answers, one of which Scott's team did give.
Yeah.
None of which were thought to be true by the Lord of the Rings fan who was writing into the Eye Shield.
I don't know Lord of the Rings well, but some people were saying that Gollum was the first hobbit to hold the ring, but that wasn't true because Gollum is described as being from a hobbit-like race rather than actually being a hobbit. Or I don't know. I don't like Lord of the Rings.
I don't know anything about it, really. The three acceptable answers in the riddle book from the board game are Bilbo, which Scott's team gave, Smeagol, or Gollum. Someone else thought it wasn't any of those. It was Deagol. soul or something? I don't know. It is quite interesting to read some of those answers in the riddle book. There are also some amusing misprints. For example, with the riddle about Richard's beaver from series one, the line, "Its coat is costly, but it isn't a mink," is written as, "Its coat is costly, but it isn't a mind." Now, mines don't really have coats, do they?
No.
So those are good for a laugh. There are also some unused riddles that are clearly meant to be asked by wall monsters. I think particularly of one that has a small anecdote attached to it. Invaders came upon these shores. A book they wrote of land and laws. A book to wrap a kingdom in. So name it Puny Mannequin.
Oh, hang on. Doomsday Book?
Correct.
I'm smart, me.
I am smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-T.
I always envision Igneous asking that. I can very much think of Edmund Dens booming that out to a dungeoneer in his contemptuous way. Puny Mannequin. At one point, I was playing the Nightmare board game with a friend and neighbour, and she asked this riddle as part of the gameplay to her own mother and everyone else who was in the room at the time, which was me, my mother, Rosie, and this girl's early teenaged brother. We're all absolutely falling about laughing and saying, "Puny Mannequin, what a thing to call your mum." Which I might not put forward for the funniest thing ever mentioned on this podcast, but it does at least show how about 95% of the truly stimulating moments in my life have involved Nightmare in some way, which is why it means so much to me. What I've been saying about the riddle book from the board game links into Oakley's final riddle here, because this riddle has an alternative phrasing in the book, which actually kind of makes it scan more. Oakley asks it on the show like this: "Parasite on trees it is, berries white it is, kisses it gets. Name it."
They do give the correct answer, which is mistletoe. It is a parasitic plant, meaning it must grow on other trees to thrive. It grows in spherical clusters and appears to spring magically from tree branches. It extracts nutrients and water from the tree it grows on, although it does also use photosynthesis to get its own nutrients. It doesn't usually kill the trees, but it can weaken them. Despite its romantic reputation, the entire plant is toxic to berries, stem, and leaves. Symptoms include blurred vision, fever, hallucinations, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, drowsiness, slowing of the heart rate, heart problems, and the possibility of miscarriage in pregnant women.
In the riddle book, this is written as, "Parasite it is, berries white it is," which scans better, doesn't it? But they've put in "on trees" as a kind of bit of help there. But I mean, it should be quite obvious. It's a plant. It's got berries.
Yeah.
Oakley's asking about it. So I do think "on trees" is an unnecessary addition.
Yeah, plus "parasite" and "berries white" is actually quite a good rhyme.
Yeah, so it no longer scans, but at least we do get to hear Oakley repeat it in a rather annoyed way. I like the way Clifford Norgate does that. It's rather a nice character moment. It's a bit of a tense moment. They've got one right, one wrong. We want to see them get this one right, don't we?
Two is the score. Oakley tells the team that the glove holds nothing before going back to sleep. A Protopuka appears, and in a slight panic, the team repeatedly tell Jeremy to take it without being clear what it is.
All right, take
it. Oh, hurry.
Oh, quick, get it.
Quick, get the golden knee.
Just take it.
Get the golden knee.
And now...
Quickly, there's a dangerous haunting.
It.
Get the golden the
just
and the egg
it.
Timer.
Just
get the golden
it.
The egg timer. Got it?
Okay, I've got them.
Okay,
fine.
Side step to your right.
Forward.
And hold up the ice shield.
Forward, hold up the ice shield. Okay, sides. Okay, forward. Okay, you're in front of a room.
Now listen, team. These are the remains of Dungarth.
Once a proud palace of men and a sanctuary from the predators of the forest. The way in to level two lies hidden here, but go forward with caution. The opposition sacked Dungarth many years ago, but still maintains a freelance guard on the place.
Isn't it rumored to be the haunt of assassins, Master?
Indeed. A nasty little cult, the assassins. Adept at ambush.
The passive path continues on the approach to Dungarth as the team try to hurry the pre-recorded footage. It's funny, isn't it? First you've got Alexander saying, now slow down a bit, slow down. Yeah. And then 2 seconds later, right, you can hurry on now. Hurry on, when he's realised, oh yeah, this is just some more pre-recorded footage to go through. I must say, by this stage, I was disappointed by how much we were seeing Dungarth and how little we were seeing the Castle of Doom. I wanted to see it again. I wanted to see Alistair's route to it used again. It's only used that once. But they're very much stuck on Dungarth now.
All right. Okay, you're just in front of a portal. Sidestep to your right, quickly.
The team are about to guide Jeremy onwards when ominous music begins to play and an assassin walks into view with its knife held high.
Stop. Now go forward. Quick, Alex, run!
All assassins are cowards, Alex. All you need to do is shout at it.
Shout at it! Jeremy, shout at it! Say stop!
Go away, anything!
Just say go away! Just go away!
That's it. Turn around and hold up the ice shield quickly, Jeremy.
Turn around. Stop. Okay, go forward.
I quite like Pickle addressing some of the advisors individually.
I do like the way Pickle adds that personal touch to his interactions with the teams.
Yeah.
I do think it works well on the screen. I think it must be nice for them having, as Paul McIntosh said in the ice shield at one point, someone who's clearly on their side.
But it also ensures that they get individual screen time as well, which is going to be good for when they're watching it back and they can point it out to their friends and their mums and stuff.
As I've said before, I do think Pickle adds quite a bit to the show without taking away from Tregar's character or Tregar's role. And I do like him for that. Got anything else to say about this assassin?
Not really. I mean, they eventually managed to get Jeremy to shout the assassin away. It seems to take a while, but...
I must say, actually, unlike Vicky, Jeremy does do a good shout. Go away!
And it's the fact that he's kind of turned to face the assassin to do it as well, which you don't actually notice at first because the assassin's in the way.
Yeah, he's probably reached the back wall of the blue room, hasn't he?
Yeah. One thing I will say about this assassin, it seems like a really small thing, but I think it makes a difference. The fact the hood is pointed way up. And I think if there was like a fold in the hood, so it was pointing downwards, it would almost seem a bit more menacing and less cartoony.
Mm, I know what you mean. I have noticed that about the assassins. Mm. And yeah... the downward point is better.
He looks like a Jawa.
Certainly when this was first on, I did find it kind of tense because it takes Jeremy so long to actually shout at it. The assassin's getting very close.
Yeah, and of course the music helps.
The music does help, yeah.
Stop. Okay, you're on this pitch and there's a large reptile in front of me and it's moving.
But so... I wouldn't stop too long.
So I said, well, how about sidestep to right? Quick.
I think they just use the lizard as sort of filler for when the episode's running a little bit short, you know, just like it needs a few extra seconds. It's probably better than putting it in along the passive path.
Yeah, they use it with Vicky. They use it here. Not overused. Mm. Just something to fill in the time and make us sit up and take notice. The reactions of Pickle and the team, goodness gracious, and things are quite good. Yeah, I quite enjoy those couple of Dungar lizard scenes for what they are, little bits of filler.
Okay, you're on a bridge and it's leading to... castle. And there's a moving sort of, it's like an escalator in front of you.
And now we get to the entrance to the conveyor corridor, which is a little different, at least visually this time, because although it is the entrance to the conveyor corridor, it's not the same almost random castle room that it usually is. But the production team have decided to use the drawbridge location from Leeds Castle, which is usually reserved for the first door monster. Nothing else has really changed, though, and Skull Haunting appears to hurry Jeremy along the main corridor. Though I will say, I think having the entrance in this backdrop seems to make a bit more sense visually. But also, look carefully at Jeremy's legs as he enters the scene. The backdrop image isn't quite aligned properly. His legs kind of cross the little bit of blackness that is at the bottom of the screen.
You know, that's something I'm going to have to watch out for the next time. You've given me a genuine surprise there.
So I'm not sure if it will show on like your VHS recordings. Maybe it's just like the, you know, watching it on a higher quality screen.
Actually, yeah, watching it on the computer and even watching it on DVD on the computer, that is something I've noticed in places. What I want to say about this, the conveyor belt being at the entrance to Leeds Castle, where, yes, we usually see Doris, I believe this was the first place they actually put the conveyor belt before doing anything else with it. And this is one of these observations, theories that I don't have evidence for. It's for you to look at the footage and decide for yourself. But every time we see the entrance to the conveyor corridor, it does actually have this doorway from Leeds Castle around it. Now, it doesn't have the rest of the room. It doesn't have the walls and the bath and the barred window and the lamp and whatever. But they've cut out the actual archway, as you see it here with a conveyor belt behind it, recolored it and stuck it on the wall wherever the conveyor belt is.
Okay.
You can see an apple on the floor.
Yeah.
Can you pick it up and put it in your hat?
Sure. Too fast, team, too fast. You need to save time and perhaps stop the action.
Advisor Alex quickly works out that Jeremy needs to use the hourglass to stop the conveyor so that Jeremy can exit. Jeremy turns the hourglass upside down and the conveyor conveniently stops right by what Traegard refers to as a nice door. Jeremy exits into the new area.
Whenever Rosie or I are telling each other we're going to turn something upside down for any reason, which sometimes happens if we're building self-assembly furniture or something, we start by saying, turn it round. Turn it upside down. And that comes from this scene with Jeremy. They're having some trouble expressing to Jeremy, turn the egg timer hourglass upside down and turn it round. Isn't quite right, is it?
No.
So Traegard helps them with, turn it upside down.
Mm.
And then they do so. So that's a quotable nightmare moment for me. Turn it round.
You know the timer? Turn it round. Turn it round.
What?
Stand it. Just put it on the escalator.
Turn it round.
Turn it upside down.
Turn it upside down, that's it.
That's it.
Okay. Now just leave it.
There's a nice door.
You know what?
Okay, now stand up. Side steps to your right.
Go down the wellway.
Okay. Jeremy, stop. Right, you're in a room and there's a wellway. So we finally... Okay.
Hold up, hold up, hold up. What have we got here?
Uh-oh.
One of them dungy thingies in one of them moo cow helmets. Well, I hate dungy thingies. I hate dungeoneers, nasty little vermin. So, I am going to blip you, and then I am going to blop you. I haven't got a blip blop in years.
The wellway chamber. And it's today located in the fireplace chamber at the castle, which makes a change from having it in the courtyard. It's only a cosmetic change, really, as Fatilla is still on guard duty. Jeremy shows Fatilla the gold, and Fatilla makes an appreciative sound as he admires the shiny object. Jeremy tells the barbarian that he'll hand over the gold if he can pass. And this bit, for me, is one of Fatilla's funniest lines.
Yeah, well, I'm a big softy, all right. Yeah, give me the gold and I'll let you through. Yeah. Thank you very much. It's nice and beautiful and shiny, and I lied.
I absolutely love Michael Kuehl. His brilliant performances, improvisation performances on Nightmare. And this one is absolutely excellent.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you like Michael Kuhl, you'll be wanting to tune in for the next episode because we have a very special guest on.
I wonder who that could be.
Gee, I wonder.
I think it's a good use for this room, the railway. An important moment for Fertilla there. And again, the team do seem rather caught in the headlights here.
Yes.
Pickle is really having to jolly them along. Think, what else have you got? And then we get to see that nice bit of variety, the joke spell.
Think, what else have you got?
Joke, joke. The joke, spellcast joke. J, spellcasting, J, O, K, E. Make us way to the well. Go to the well. Sidestep to your right. Sidestep to your right.
He still hasn't got to blip and blop anyone. Even Cedric got to clobber one person.
It would be a rather good scene.
Never mind. He's still an entertaining character.
He's tremendously entertaining. Fertilla laughs uncontrollably, slapping his thigh with his club as Jeremy climbs into the well. Thinking specifically about Motley having given the spell, not only is it more appropriate to Motley the character than the spell you'll see him give out to Giles in the next episode, It's also better used. Next time, when you get the dash spell, well, anyone could give that, couldn't they? It's not particularly appropriate to a Joker, but it then gets used immediately in an anomalous scene right after the crazed heifer, and then we can forget all about it. This joke scenario is much better. Get a joke spell from a Joker, save it up and use it at the end of the level for a really good scene. Yes, that gets the thumbs up from me.
Calm down. Yes, calm down. Calm down, quick. It won't last for long.
Listeners, if you're like us and you enjoy these railway scenes, enjoy it while it lasts. I'm afraid we've only got a couple more episodes.
I mean, would it have killed them to bring back the railways for Series 8 instead of those time-consuming trapdoors? Well, that's something for another day, isn't it?
Okay, Jeremy, you're standing on a table in the chamber, and there's a goblin statue with flashing eyes. And there's a chair to your right.
Yes, I see it.
Okay.
Extreme warning, team. This heathen idol has what they call the evil eye. Whilst it continues to look on you, extreme energy drain is occurring.
The chamber is the old familiar circular room, which is usually prevalent in level 3, but this is the first time it's been used in level 2. There's an evil statue eating away at the Dungeoneer's life force. The team instruct Jeremy to pick up the cloth from the table and place it over the statue's eyes. Although they don't do that at first because they don't realise there's a cloth on the table at first. I can kind of see why that would be easily missed.
Yeah, it's another one of these very panicky, rather haphazard scenes. Does inject some life into the show, I think. Pick whatever's up on the table. What is it? Put it over his face. Quickly, you must hurry. Put it over his eyes. It's a simple thing to do, and the outcome's never really in any doubt. But quite a fun little adrenaline-fueled scene, I think.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would say about this bit is that I wish they'd chosen a different sound effect. The beeping sounds too electronic to me.
It does sound very electronic.
Mm.
It adds to the impression of the eyes being like flashing lights.
Even if they use like the, you know, like this sound effect they used to use for the swords, for the sword hauntings.
That would certainly give you the idea that energy drain was occurring.
Pick whatever's up on the table. What is it?
What is it?
Piece of cloth. Put it over his
face. Quickly, you must hurry.
Put it over his eyes, quick. That's it.
Oh, well.
What's our exit? Let's escape.
This is the point where I'm kind of having enough of the team.
And you're not the only one, are you? Tim Child agrees.
They've been given enough chances now.
It is indeed unusual to see this familiar circular room in level 2 instead of level 3. It does kind of make me wonder if it's being used here because there was already a kind of idea to stage the statue draining your life force scene in this room with Alistair in level 3, and that's why Alistair had picked up the strange cloth with gold markings from the clue table. It may have been to put over the face of a energy draining statue.
Yeah, I think maybe the idea to use the statue in level 3 was there, but I don't think it makes much difference with the actual room itself because it's just a backdrop.
Logically, it shouldn't make a difference, should it? I have just thought at times, if this scene was planned to be in level 3 and had been staged like this, have they brought this level 3 room up to level 2 without bothering to think, oh, what other room could we have the scene in? I don't know.
It does feel more like a level 3 puzzle, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's something very level 3-y about the whole thing, and the room itself does add to that.
Well done, young thingamabob! Well done indeed! Cool! Ooh, here! Miss Melisandre, come and take a gander at this bit of ugliness.
Motley, that's awful!
Recognise yourself, did you?
And so are you. Just take no notice of him. He doesn't know anything anyway.
I do like them together, as I said on episode 1 of this series. And how many times do they actually appear together on screen? 4. 2 in series 3, 2 in series 4. Yeah, much as I enjoy Motley's later interactions with Gwendolyn and Stiletta and the scene he had with Gundrada, with his lust kind of showing through, I always think Motley and Melly do seem like they have a good double act and they have some sort of emotional connection.
So Melisandre, or Smelly Melly, as Motley refers to her, asks Jeremy if he'd like a game of Riddle-O-Ree. Jeremy asks his team if he would, and before they can reply, Melly poses a riddle anyway.
Riddle-O-Ree begins with a T. It's tortoise on land and turtle in sea. But now you must think of, and then must deliver, the name of its cousin that lives in the river. Oh, very good, Mel. Most poetic.
First of all, points for the rhyming.
Yeah, it's genuinely good rhyming.
Also, I didn't know the answer. Well, until they said the answer, and I was like, of course it is. Unfortunately, the team did know the answer, and it's a terrapin. Terrapins, as we all know, are endemic to North America, and Europeans found them in the early 1500s. There are currently approximately 100 species of terrapins found throughout North America, and a terrapin resembles a turtle, but has a longer tail and webbed feet. It also had a big skull and a beak-shaped nose. The shell consists of three parts, the carapace, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong.
Carapace, I should think, yeah.
Which is the top, the plastron, which is the bottom, and the neck. A mature female terrapin can weigh up to 30 pounds or more. Unfortunately, I didn't get the measurement of that in Madagascan penguins. Although an adult male may only weigh 10 to 15 pounds. Under ideal conditions, their life expectancy is from 15 to 20 years, but it can reach 30 years depending on the species.
Now, doing a little research at one point, I was rather disappointed to read that some people think the only difference between a terrapin and a freshwater turtle is a judgment. But you've got a couple of potential differences there, longer tail and webbed feet. So I'm very glad to know if they really are.
This is around the time when terrapins became very popular pets because of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Heroes in a half shell, turtle power! Which is a whole sad thing because people didn't realize how long they live and how much care they required. There's this like urban legend of terrapins breeding in the sewers, which is quite ironic, really, considering the Ninja Turtles link, because they were flushed down the toilet.
Pets as fads. Yeah, that is a very sad story. And it shows something fundamentally wrong with certain people who will buy a living creature and not really think of it as a living creature. I find that very disturbing and depressing, that sort of story. If you like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, great, but buy the action figures. Well, not that you can find the action figures very easily.
People buy pets for children because they claim it helps to teach them responsibility, but they need to be responsible themselves before they buy them and do some bloody research.
That old maxim, a dog is for life, not just for Christmas. It's so true. And it's so true of any living creature you make a commitment to. And when people don't take that commitment seriously, I do think that is terrible.
Mm.
And it does make me very sad. And I think it's indicative of something bad in human nature that we should all make the effort to overcome for the sake of fellow living creatures.
People like say, oh, a hamster's a good pet for a child because hamsters don't live too long. And it teaches the child responsibility and also as the offshoot of teaching the child about loss as well. Thing is, hamsters don't live that long because they keep getting given as pets to children. That's why they don't live that long.
We've got to be prepared to make that lifelong commitment to any animal we take into our homes, however long it may last.
Yeah.
And do our absolute best to care for them all the way through their lives. Only a few months ago, Rosie and I had rather a sad bereavement. We'd had this cat for just over 13 years. She suffered a series of strokes and passed away one Friday evening. And it was quite a difficult time when she couldn't really eat properly and she had some incontinence. We got hold of some medication to help her with that. And there was a lot of sort of clearing up to do and rather distressing times to go through. Eventually, she had a major stroke and passed away on our bath mat. But I was very committed to keeping her as comfortable as possible and helping her through those times, even though she wasn't giving us the cuddles and things anymore, because obviously her life was coming to its natural end. And it was important to help her through that to the very last stage. That kind of lifelong commitment, I think, is important for pets, however long their life might be. And if you're not properly committed to it, pray that someone doesn't have the same lack of respect for your life someday. That's what I say.
Pets give a lot to you. You have to be prepared to give a lot to them in return. I remember going with my ex to choose a cat from a new litter. I wanted to take them all home, of course. But we chose one and we named her Folly. And then she had a litter herself. And one of them we named Millie after Melisandre.
There's something I've never had, a nightmare named pet.
Terrapin.
That's right. Now I've got something for you. It's a joker. I'll be certain you play it at the right time. Because it can only be used once. Now come on, Motley, we best be going.
It's Motley, Melisandre, it's Motley!
Okay. So well done. Well, turn around and onward, team. Hold up the eye shield.
Yes, it's particularly weird seeing that passive path not in level 3.
Yeah.
We associate it with, oh, they're going deep into the dungeon. They've got spells from Hordris to do exciting climactic scenes with. But in this case, no. It's just getting out of the first room of level 2.
Go forward.
It's getting very dark.
Stop. There's a gap on the right.
Everything
wall.
Moves here, Jeremy, and you better move too.
Okay, quickly. Move to your right, quick.
We reach the block and tackle, and it's at this point that the team's panic gets the better of them. It starts off okay with them sidestepping Jeremy to the right out of immediate danger, but rather than going for the obvious path and going through the right-hand door, they instead opt for the rapidly disappearing pathway to the left. They narrowly avoid walking him directly into a pit, but this is a little consolation as the flagstone Jeremy is walking across falls away and he plummets to his doom.
Sidestep to right, mate, stop. Okay, run. Run! Wait, stop!
What a pity. A fatal error of timing, I'm afraid, team. And now it's time for you to leave us. Spellcasting! D-I-S-M-I-S-S. There! I think you'll find things a bit safer outside the dungeon. Now, the road to London is signposted just over the hill. So farewell, Jeremy, and the 3 A's, and good luck.
Take me down to the grass by the castle, because we died when our quest proved too much hassle. Oh, won't you please take me home?
This, I think, should be as famous as Simon Sidestep Right.
This, I think, really shows how they do want to get rid of Jeremy at this stage. You see how he's pointing when he comes in? Right diagonally over to the left. And no one on the team takes the initiative to turn him before moving him. So, of course, he walks straight onto the collapsing bit. It's never going to end any other way, is it? With how panicky this team have become, with the way Jeremy comes into the room, and with Giles and team waiting in the wings, yeah, this is the end of this quest, and that's all there is to it. I mean, we wouldn't normally see it so early in level two, would we? It's just here to do what it does.
I think the block and tackle is very much used as a quest killer when they've had enough of the team.
That's right.
And I think this is the right place for them to be killed off.
Yeah. They've been entertaining, but we're probably ready to move on to something new now. The block and tackle creates this impression of being, wow, this really tough killer puzzle. It was the first ever Remember This in the iShield fanzine. Paul McIntosh calls it the ultimate dungeon killer.
Mm.
That's how it appears. It has the three deaths. As we know, it's used to kill Vicky off early. She's squashed by a block. She doesn't even fall in the hole because they haven't got Merlin's magic to use on Ariadne, not there in that room, despite what Traeger says. It's used here to kill off Jeremy. The genuine death there that wasn't necessarily going to happen is Simon, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's one piece of poor manoeuvring that does it.
In the podcast, we refer to the Corridor of Blades as the ultimate dungeon is But that's because it rhymes for the jingle. This is probably the... Does this have a bigger kill count than the Corridor of Blades?
As a raw statistic, the Corridor of Blades has one more kill than this.
Oh, really?
Four kills in the Corridor of Blades, three kills in the block and tackle. Those kills in the Corridor of Blades, of course, are spread over a very long period.
Yeah.
I think we've managed to get to the end of Jeremy, haven't we?
We have. There's nothing particularly bad about them. There's nothing that stands out as particularly good. They have their moments. They're quite good at answering most of the riddles. They were unfortunate to have to follow on from Dickens' team.
They're never going to get done any favours, at least, we can say.
But Dickens' team was such a high that anything following it is probably going to feel a bit disappointing. They are way too panicky.
Yeah.
They're not the worst we've seen.
I think they do suffer from their youth in that way. I do like them. I do find them entertaining. I do enjoy their interplay. There's something very genuine about some of their panicky moments. It's all good, genuine stuff, and they provide an entertaining bridge between two much longer quests.
Yeah.
Which is obviously what they were brought on for, and yeah, they do a good job fulfilling their role. Like that door in the conveyor belt.
A nice door. A nice quest.
A nice door, a nice quest, a nice team.
Just a bit too green.
Yes, a bit too green, exactly.
I think we can stop worrying about them and start worrying about the next lot. Oh, by the way, I think they've arrived. So, enter, stranger. Now, challenger, name yourself.
Giles Milner from Hampshire.
Giles, it must have come miles.
I think you'd better call your advisors quickly.
Robin, Andrew, Brett, come.
Welcome.
As usual, Traeger wastes no time in getting the next team in. Giles, Robin, Andrew, and Brett seem plucky enough. Traeger gives the usual brief rundown, plonks the knapsack and helmet on the dungeoneer, and yeets him through the door.
Turn now, face the dungeon door, and step boldly forward. Now listen, team. Choose now. The quest to redeem the Sword of Freedom or to find the cup that healed.
Okay, Giles, do you think we should go for the cup?
Yeah.
Well, hey, engineer, with the helmet on your head, but you go for the cup or the crown instead of the sword and the shield, because there's nothing in between. Oh, hey, adventure, don't be alarmed, but one false move can cause you harm. If you slip out the disc, you'll end up in a ravine. At the place of choice. At the place of choice. The place of choice. At the place of choice.
Giles's mount and dismount of the wheel are better than most dungeoneers, although still a little wobbly. He's not on the wheel for long before he makes it onto the selected path towards the cup that heals. It's obviously heavily edited, this place of choice. I think someone's realised when we paused at the place of choice with Nikki and she hadn't chosen her quest object, it was a bit awkward to start the next episode. You couldn't put the little status bar up. So literally the one thing Giles does in this episode is walk through the cup door so that next time people can say they're on the quest for the cup. And a quick little skip across the wheel. And as you say there, he does it pretty well.
Yeah, definitely not the worst.
I did want to say about the place of choice, actually, here for its last appearance. The last time we'll ever see it.
Salute to the place of choice.
Having taken another look at David Rowe's Art of Nightmare and his preliminary sketches for the place of choice and the Veil of Mogdred, I have actually rather gone off the idea that they might really have anything to do with each other. They do have completely different sketches, preliminary sketches, perspectives and that sort of thing. As we were saying on the episode one podcast for this series, there may be some kind of mountain on each side base sketch that David Rowe works from to get both the runes, but that would be the only real link between them, I think. Yeah, they are really two separately sketched and drawn nightmare rooms, and I do want the listeners of Illusion to know that, and also to know that I do rate David Rowe's Art of Nightmare very highly as the primary nightmare resource for picking up little tidbits like that. It's not always things that David has put in there deliberately. Little bits of information from Tim Child's old yellowed faxes from 1986 can be very revealing. The names of the rooms that David Rowe was given, like the Vale of Banburn, for example, was the big one, a big revelation there. But also things like Merlin's Level 3 chamber from Series 1 to 3 is given to David to produce as Wall of Jericho / Mogdred room. Now, doesn't that open up some interesting revelations?
Yeah.
And yeah, David Rowe's Art of Nightmare can show you little snippets like that that just make those connections and support theories like that.
Master, I hate to tell you this, but...
Oh, no. This is ludicrous. Pickle, can't you watch for the signs more carefully? Sorry, boys. Too late. Into limbo before they've hardly started.
Can they still hear us?
No, I don't think so. But don't say anything rude about them, just in case.
What about them? Can they still hear us?
Oh, yes. You can say what you like about them. Hard as nails they are.
Yes. See what you mean?
The credits play over the footage of a dungeoneer questing through the grounds surrounding a castle. Notice how the shield that the dungeoneer is carrying is not the eye shield, but is in fact the shield used as a clue object in Series 1 and 2. When it was revealed on the forum at some point, this was supposed to be a possible new opening sequence for the programme.
That makes sense, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense, particularly with the word nightmare coming up in blue over the moat at Framlingham Castle at the end of it.
Mm.
And I guess they wouldn't have wanted to spoil the appearance of the eye shield in the first episode. That's going to be the opening to it. But it's kind of indicative of the eye shield, isn't it?
Yeah, or maybe that's what they were going to use as the eye shield. You never know.
Could be. It could be from an earlier stage before they really finalised the eye shield. It's a nice little sequence, I think.
Mm.
But I'm glad they didn't use it as the opening. I was saying about episode 11... That was kind of a tick-along episode, not much to complain about, but not much going on. This is kind of a tick-along episode too, but I think I do enjoy it more than episode 11 for the reasons we've been discussing. Slightly new, slightly interesting situations, particularly the joke spell. More than enough to keep me interested after Dickens' exciting win in the previous episode.
Yeah, it's fine. It's not the best. It's definitely not the worst. It's fine.
And if they're trying to hold our attention until the end of the series, I think they're doing a pretty good job here, keeping us on our toes.
So if you've enjoyed the podcast, please give a rating and review on your platform of choice. It really helps us to grow our audience by reaching others who might be interested.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're @NightmarePod and our Mastodon is topspicy.social/@nightmarepod.
If you want to support the podcast, we're Nightmare Pod on Patreon.
Speaking of Patreon, here's a shout out to
Keepers of the Book of Quests, David N. Rabbit, Paul McIntosh, Peter Pulsford, and Scott Evans.
Advisors Benjamin Bloom, David Thompson, Kim Harder, which is a perfectly fine surname, Peter Sidorn, Paul Craddy, Lord Entropy, where the O is a zero, and Stephen Whalen.
And let's not forget Dungeoneers Peter Courage and Adam Battersby.
Support the podcast on Patreon at Dungeoneer level or above to get your name mentioned on the podcast. Higher level perks also receive merchandise, have access to exclusive episodes, and if you pledge as a keeper of the Book of Quests, you'll even be offered the chance to be a guest on the podcast. You'll probably ramble less than I have done this time.
Our website is nightmarepod.co.uk.
If you're looking for temporal discussion merchandise, which you probably are, including t-shirts, stickers, and other products, it's nightmarepod.redbubble.com.
You can email us at podcast@nightmarepod.co.uk.
And just keep telling yourself, it's only a podcast, isn't it? God, you should cut all this. It's crap.